This is 89.9 WWNL. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood to cheer on our local arts community or celebrate Black History Month, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Dance, opera, and classical music are in the spotlight as nominees in each category gear up for Gambit's tribute to the Classical Arts Awards luncheon this week. Two special honors highlight this year's event. We begin with Tulane University Professor of Dance, choreographer and former dancer Barbara Haley, who is being celebrated with Gambit's Lifetime Achievement Award. Barbara, congratulations.
Thank you. This is the first time hearing that out loud, orally.
How did you get the news that you were this year's Lifetime Achievement honoree?
I had a phone call from John Broder at Gambit, and actually it was a text or an email, and said, I need to talk with you as soon as possible. I have some information about the Classical Arts Awards. And that's how I found out.
Wow. You have garnered many career awards over the years. What makes this one special?
This is special, and I'm deeply honored and thrilled. It is a longer-term recognition, I suppose, which is amazing. I am not a fan, generally, of one-person awards. You know, I embrace our community here and all the dancers and collaborators I've worked with in contributing to this moment.
So tell us, how did your journey begin? When did you know that expressive dance would be your life's work?
I loved dancing. I was five.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful woman from the Polish National Ballet that taught me ballet. But I would say college was modern dance, contemporary dance introduction in a real way. And then New York City, I had wonderful, amazing mentors and teachers there so that dance could be used as a tool for expression, for social change, for enlightenment of issues that matter, you know, evolved over time, and certainly coming to New Orleans with our challenges and celebrations, I found many avenues for work in the arts, in the performing arts.
So what makes your heart smile as you look back on your accomplishments?
Oh, good question. I would say that finding the triad of teaching, choreography, and performance, and working with collaborators makes my heart smile. And my two main teaching collaborators are Elise Pascal Escher and Beverly Trask. We have been working together for more than 30 years, and that was a combination of the stars.
And this happened at Tulane.
This is at Tulane University, Newcomb Dance Program. And we are actually celebrating our 35th anniversary of the Newcomb Dance Company in March.
Congratulations. I see your career at one point took you all the way around the world to Russia.
That was a Fulbright Senior Scholar Award, and it was life-changing in terms of living in another culture for a year, approximately, more like 10 months. And they said that at the orientation for the Fulbright in Washington, they said it would be life-changing. I don't know that it flipped my life upside down, but it certainly informed me of the larger global condition. In a way that I had visiting countries or vacations or tourist involvement did not. The dancers and artists in Russia were amazing and breaking ground, trailblazing in modern dance at the time, 1997, 1998, I was there. So it was certainly after Perestroika, but it was allowing people to voice their individual creation and invention. And they were inventing. So it was my pleasure to be there.
Now, Barbara, are you a native New Yorker?
I am not. I am a native of Pennsylvania and then moved to New York City for about 10 years before moving to New Orleans.
And what attracted you to this city?
Well, I visited once alone to visit some relatives that lived in Baton Rouge. But then I met a guy in New York City, Bob Roberts, who lived here, who is a native of New Orleans. And we were both ready to leave New York City. So my husband brought me here. And interestingly, at the same time, the job became available at the Newcomb Dance Program at Tulane in 1985.
Well, that was a win-win.
It was amazing.
Now, upon arriving in New Orleans, you created New Orleans Dance, a modern dance repertory company, and this was back in the late 80s. Are you still at the helm as artistic director?
I am, but it's a project-based company now.
Which means what?
Essentially, contained projects, not a commitment to an annual year's concert.
Going forward, how would you like to push the envelope on what has been a marvelous career in dance?
Oh, I thank you so much. You know, I don't know where this adage came from or proverb, but it ain't over till the fat lady sings, right? So I feel like there's way more to do. I do love that I am still working in that triad. In fact, we will be doing something on the stage. That is Elise Beverly and I on the 35th anniversary. But mostly choreographing, working with students. I love my students. They're so smart and creative, and working with other dancers in this community. It's amazing. This community abounds with inspiration. I'm inspired. I would love to be here 50 years from now to see what's going on. I just think dance and the performing arts particularly are at a point of explosion, a point of coming together, a point of making major impact in our performance world and also with the public.
Barbara Haley, Tulane University Professor of Dance, is Gambit's Classical Arts Lifetime Achievement Award honoree. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Diane.
And classical piano hits the high notes at the Classical Arts Awards as Gambit honors Masna's New Orleans Piano Institute with its Education Award. Musical Arts Society of New Orleans Executive Director Kara McCool-Wolf joins us with New Orleans Piano Institute Co-Director Joni Jensen. Congrats!
Thanks.
Thank you.
This program is a feather in the cap for Masna as you are growing new seed, giving budding classical pianists incredible opportunities on the concert stage. I can only imagine your excitement when you learned it was chosen for this special honor, Gambit's Education Award. What emotions are you going through right about now, Kara?
Well, we're just so excited to be recognized. Our institute is in the summertime, and we welcome students from New Orleans, but also internationally. A lot of times in the summer, the classical organizations don't have as much going on, and they aren't known as much. So we were really thrilled to get this exposure and for people to learn more about this top institute in the greater New Orleans area.
And Joni?
We have a wonderful faculty that come, and they put so much hard work into it, and the students get so much out of it. It's just really nice to be recognized for our hard work.
Is the New Orleans Piano Institute an outgrowth of Masna's New Orleans Keyboard Festival?
Yes, it is. This is actually the 20th year of the Piano Institute, believe it or not. And it was established in 99 by Raymond Gitz and Sharon Horton. And it has grown, I believe it's been at max capacity for probably the last 4 or 5 years.
It has. And our max capacity is about 36 students. They really do come and they spend maybe about 8 days in New Orleans, and most of the time they're working very, very hard, practicing, taking lessons, performing, and they are meeting new friends all the time. So,
who's eligible to participate?
Well, we invite junior high, high school, and college-age pianists from around the world to audition and apply for this institute. And then our co-directors, Joni Jensen, who's here with us today, and also Igor Reznansky, who was actually a former gold medalist of our New Orleans International Piano Competition, they select the 35 or 36 students who will come and spend the week here in New Orleans. And it's a wonderful networking opportunity for them as well, because our faculty is international and they teach at some of the very top music schools in the world. For instance, we have Alan Chow from the Eastman School of Music, and these kids come and they study with these faculty and they meet other peers from around the world, and they're able to network for higher education opportunities and performance opportunities.
Can you tell us a story about some of the students whose careers have been enhanced by the program?
Our biggest success story is Kenny Broberg, who started as a student at the Institute. He studied at the University in Texas with Nancy Weems, who has also been on our faculty. And he won our concerto competition that year, so he came back and played with the Civic Symphony. And then a few years later, he came back as a competitor in the international piano competition. And he won
bronze. He was a bronze medalist.
And then he went on to compete in the Van Cliburn competition.
And he won the
silver medal.
2017. Yeah. And now we're really thrilled because we just confirmed that he'll be joining us again in November for our big gala nocturne. He'll be our artist. So it's been really fun to be a part of his musical journey.
And what would you say is your ultimate goal with the Piano Institute?
Just to continue offering this wonderful instruction for the students. And I think we're doing a pretty good job, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's Masno's largest educational component, and part of our mission is nurturing young talent and supporting emerging artists. It's a huge part of that. We are just proud to get to play these roles in these young musicians' lives and give them the support they need to be successful musicians.
Masno Executive Director Kara McCool-Wolf and New Orleans Piano Institute Co-Director Joni Jensen, congrats on your success.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks for having us, Diane.
Gambidge Tribute to the Classical Arts Awards Luncheon takes place at 11 a.m. Friday, February 22nd at the Hotel Monteleone. More information is online at bestofneworleans.com/classicalarts. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The essence of a 19th century civil rights crusader comes to life as Dillard University Theater continues its premiere of award-winning playwright Carolyn Nerwistrand's stage drama, Ida B. and the Lynching Tree. It is the story of journalist and NAACP founding member Ida B. Wells and her anti-lynching campaign. Playwright Carolyn Nerwistrand joins us with actress Alexandria Lofton. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you for having us.
So much.
Ida B. Wells was a black female activist fighting against prejudice and violence in the early days of the civil rights movement. Carolyn, tell us, what attracted you to her story?
Ida B. Wells has always been one of the most important 19th century women, and her legacy as our first investigative journalist and sense of justice has always attracted me. In her autobiography, she begins speaking about the importance of youth understanding race history of the 19th century. And because of her own words of this importance, I was attracted to her story. Ida B. was a controversial figure during her lifetime because of her uncompromising and militant stand at all times in seeking justice against the Jim Crow laws. This sense of justice is what really drives our play.
Alexandria, you play the older or the more mature Ida B.
As a person, I just love her. And after reading about her and playing her character, I just felt she paved a way for a lot of the African Americans here in the United States today. Although some of these things that she has created with the crusade against lynchings still continue these days, but in different ways, like police brutality, and in a way I feel that we are still enslaved in certain ways as a black race. But aside from all of that, she made an impact on today's society.
Can you share a little something from the production with us?
Yes, ma'am, I definitely can. This is the monologue. I think it sets the tone and the speed of the play. To keep the waters troubled was to be awake while others slept.
No sweet dreams brought me peace, knowing justice as a marble statue heard not the cries from the lynching tree. Perhaps my story will be forgotten. Perhaps America will write a different history. But youth, our youth are entitled to the facts of race history, which only the participants can give. I am thus led to set forth the facts.
This play deals with the first 30 years of Ida B. Wells' life. She was born in 1862, a month before Lincoln drafted the Emancipation Proclamation. So she was born during the time of enslavement. And we go to 1892, which was the lynching of three of her best friends in Memphis.
And her campaign against lynching, this was something that she fought with the power of journalism?
Ida B. Wells, single-handed, using the voice and through her pen and writing in most of the black newspapers across the country, brought to the attention of the nation the brutal lynchings that were happening in the South. Now, she was considered controversial even by Frederick Douglass, even by Dr. Du Bois, because of the editorial that she wrote in June of 1892. Tommy Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Henry Stewart are three black men that were lynched in Memphis because they owned a grocery store. Their grocery store was directly across the street from a white grocery store owner. And because they had a grocery store, which the people of Memphis were going to, the white store owner across the street started a mob terrorist. They were taken out of their grocery store, taken about a mile out of Memphis, and shot to death. At the time, Ida B. was in Natchez, Mississippi on a lecture. When she came back and found this, she was so concerned, so shaken up, because this was something up close and personal. These were her own dear friends. This really prompted her lynching crusade. What she discovered as she started to investigate, by 1892, we'd already had 1,000 lynchings in the South, was that the crime that continually was being said by white men was that black men were raping white women. Ida B.'s editorial in 1892 said, "Nobody," and this is a direct quote, "in this part of the country believes that old threadbare lie that black men rape white women." That editorial caused the sheriff and the people of Memphis to come into her printing press, the Free Speech, tear it down, and she was never allowed in the town again. She became an investigative journalist and went to the sites for over the rest of her life, the sites of lynching, and discovered how many times this lie, trying to defend the virtue of white women, was used as a ploy to keep the real reason for lynchings in the South were economics and status, to keep black men down. This is why lynching really occurred, and mob violence and terrorism. This is what the Ku Klux Klan were doing in the South. And she brought this to the nation's attention. Eventually, Frederick Douglass began to understand in the last 3 years of his life. Ida B. Wells was with him, and he supported her.
She was quite the crusader. Was she in fear for her own life?
Ida B. Wells, after the lynching of Tommy Moss, Calvin McDowell, and Henry Stewart, bought a pistol. And she took a pistol with her everywhere she went when she returned to the South. Now, she eventually went to Chicago, where she met Ferdinand Barnett, who was a widower and also militant in his own right. We say today militant in that they would stand up, even at the cost of their own life, for their sense of justice. And he owned the first black newspaper in Chicago, the Conservator. They married. There were six children to raise, but she continued for the rest of her life. She traveled to England. She traveled to Sweden on the lynching campaign and brought to the attention overseas the injustice of not allowing a trial, just deciding that black men did not even deserve a sense of justice in the South in America.
What is the dialogue that you hope to start with audiences long after Black History Month?
I would hope that people take from this to stand up for what they want. She was a person that was willing to risk it all to save her community and her people.
You know, in Souls of Black Folk, that was written going into the 20th century by Dr. Du Bois, he ends by talking about that history is destined to repeat itself if we do not learn from our past. Since 2012, with the slaying of Trayvon Martin, we continue to be haunted by injustice in this country based on race. And the dialogue that we must confront is why this particular injustice continues to haunt the United States. We still have to bring it out into the open so that we can eventually all bring America to the righteousness that it deserves to include for all people.
Playwright Carolyn Nur-Wistrand and actress Alexandria Lofton, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Final performances of Ida B. and the Lynching Tree run February 22nd through 24th in the Samuel Du Bois Cook Fine Arts Center on Dillard University's campus, 2601 Gentilly Boulevard. More info at 816-4857. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Christwood Retirement Community, the Contemporary Arts Center, and the New Orleans Opera Association. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45, when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.